But let's read. We'll read the first seven verses of our passage this morning in its entirety. It says this. So Israel, that's Jacob, took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba. And he offered, it says, offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. So God repeats Jacob's name. He says, Jacob, Jacob. And Jacob said, here I am. And then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob. Oh my, it's two times in three words. Crazy. Sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their goods that they had gained in the land of Canaan, and they came into Egypt. Jacob and all his offspring with him, his son and his son's sons, his daughters and his son's daughters, everything they brought, all of his offspring, he went with him into Egypt. So Jacob comes, we're first told where Jacob comes to. Where this moment happens is a place called Beersheba. Everybody say, Beersheba. Yeah, this is where this all takes place. One of the best questions we can ask when we're trying to make sense of the Bible and trying to make sense of what's going on, what God's saying is, anytime we're reading the Bible, where are we? Like physically in the story, where are we? And what's happened here before? Where are we and what's happened here before? And if we do that, we'll find, just by a turning of a few pages here and there, we'll find that Beersheba is a very important place. Because here's the deal. I've got a map, and I forgot my laser pointer in my office for the 9 a.m., and I did not learn from my mistake. I still don't have it. So here you can see on the map, Egypt is on the left, right? Do you see that? And then do you see that weird red thing? I don't even know what that is, but it's helpful for what I'm trying to say, because that little red thing that they have on this map, that's land, that's where Jacob has spent most of his life. He's kind of moved around here and there, and at the bottom of this little red spot, the southwest of that little red spot, that's where Beersheba is located. You don't notice it's kind of in the south of where Jacob has been living, and it's kind of right before you enter into Egypt. Jacob arrives at Beersheba. That's not the only reason Beersheba... Did we get that on video? I hope so. Put that on Instagram. That'll go viral. Okay. Terrifying. Thank the Lord my knee is okay. All right, let's regain composure here. What was I saying? Beersheba is an important place. Beersheba is where, not just the south part, it's amazing, the south part where Jacob, before he enters into Egypt, right? Jacob has actually been here before. In fact, Jacob is at the end of his life. He comes to Beersheba before he enters into Egypt. But at the beginning of his really adult life, in Genesis chapter 28, God came to Jacob in a vision and in a dream. And then Jacob left Beersheba and began the rest of his adult life. Jacob's been here before. But Jacob's not the only one who's been here before. Jacob's father has actually been to this place, Beersheba, before. In fact, in Genesis chapter 26, years and years before what we're reading this morning, but just a few pages in our Bibles, in chapter 26, Jacob's father Isaac, during a famine, wanted to go to Egypt, and God told him not to go to Egypt. And after God told him not to go to Egypt, Isaac built an altar at Beersheba. That's in chapter 26, years and years before what we're reading this morning, right? But we flip to chapter 46, and Jacob comes to Beersheba, and he offers a sacrifice at the altar that his father Isaac had built. And during a famine, God tells Jacob to go to Egypt. So in chapter 26, Isaac, years and years before, during a famine, God told Isaac, don't go to Egypt. And Isaac built an altar at Beersheba. In chapter 46, Jacob comes to Beersheba. He offers a sacrifice at the altar Isaac had built. And during a famine, a different famine, but during a famine, God tells Jacob to go to Egypt. This place is important. This is a significant moment. This is a significant shift in the story. Not just the story of this family, but in the biblical story as a whole. And God uses this significant shift. He marks this significant shift by coming to Jacob in a dream, in a vision, and calling his name twice. Jacob, Jacob, do not be afraid. I will make you into a great nation. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will bring you back up. This was not the first time that God had met Jacob on the way to somewhere uncertain and given a promise of his presence to go with him. But this was the last time God comes to Jacob and says, Jacob, Jacob, I will go with you. Do not be afraid. You know, Jewish rabbis have often asked the question about these seven moments. Why would God repeat these people's name at this time? And the two sort of proposals have often been, maybe it's out of urgency. God's trying to get these people's attention. He's trying to stop them from something and redirect them. And then the second proposal has been, maybe God is trying to communicate a love and a comfort to these people. And I think that we'll find as the weeks progress, most of these moments, it's the first. God is trying to urgently get someone's attention. Last week, we looked at Abraham in Genesis 22, right? And God's like, Abraham, Abraham, like, drop the knife. You don't got to do this, right? Next week, we'll look at Exodus 3 and Moses. God says, Moses, Moses, at the burning bush. God's trying to get Moses' attention. But this moment is unique. Jacob is asleep. Jacob is already on the way to where God is going to tell him where to go. And for those reasons, I think God repeats Jacob's name out of a desire to communicate love and comfort. Jacob, Jacob, do not be afraid. I will go with you. I think that this is the call, that this is the invitation that God repeating Jacob's name extends to him. To remind Jacob that on the way to uncertainty, a place that's not the promised land, at the end of his life, during a 2-year famine, God repeats Jacob's name twice to remind him, Jacob, in the midst of uncertainty, I am certain. In the midst of uncertainty, I am certain. And there are some of us probably in the room this morning who we feel like we are on the way to somewhere uncertain. We feel like we're on the way to Egypt. Maybe you've been working a job now for a little while that's felt pretty unsteady, and layoffs keep getting talked about, and you've started to have a sneaking suspicion that maybe you're next. And you feel like you're on the way to somewhere uncertain. You feel like you're on the way to Egypt. Or maybe you put your house on the market a few months ago, and it's still on the market, and you've met with the realtor, and they've assured you everything's fine, it's going to sell, but the house is still on the market, and you feel like you're on the road on a path to somewhere uncertain. You feel like you're on the way to Egypt. Maybe recently you've had to dip into the savings that you never wanted to dip into. It was never part of the plan, but you had to. And for more reasons you can even keep straight in your brain this morning, you feel you're on the way to somewhere uncertain. You feel you're on the way to Egypt. Or maybe it's the medication that hasn't worked, and the therapy that hasn't worked, and the deep breathing exercises that hasn't worked, and the clean eating that hasn't worked. And still, every day you wake up with zero desire to get out of bed, and you feel like you are on the way to somewhere uncertain. You feel like you are on the way to Egypt. I mean, even as a church, like, we're 5 weeks old. I could not tell you where we're going to be at 5 years from now. I couldn't even tell you where we're going to be 5 months from now. Like, We don't even know who's going to clean our building this week. We don't even know who's going to mow the lawn. I'm serious. And we clearly need to build a bigger teaching little thing. So much is uncertain. Our lives are filled with all kinds of uncertainty. And I hope and I pray that this morning, through God's living and active word, that together we hear God speaking love and comfort, reminding us and telling us in the midst of uncertainty, I am certain. You know, God's promise that he makes to Jacob here in verses 3 and 4, there's kind of a connection, a really special connection actually, to chapter 28 of Genesis and some vows that Jacob had made. And I want to actually read those vows. But before I do, I want to explain why this connection is so important. And to do that, I think an illustration might be helpful. So, Britt, please don't show this photo yet. I need to preface this photo as well. I'm going to show you, this is a pretty obnoxious photo of myself, okay? I'm just going to tell you that. The story behind this photo is we had a six-month-old son at the time. We decided we wanted to get, like, lifestyle photos around our house, you know, cute photos. And we're doing it. It's going fine. And I decided, like, I need coffee. And if you don't, I love coffee. I need coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. And so I go into my kitchen and I start making coffee with my little setup. And our photographer, who's a friend of ours that we're paying to be there and take photos, he comes into the kitchen with me and starts taking photos. And I was like, stop, but don't stop. Keep taking them. And this was the result. Some of you may have seen this photo before. This is me at home making coffee. You may, if you're a real coffee head, you might recognize that's a Flair 58 lever espresso machine that I'm using, pulling right there. That's a Barossa Sette grinder behind that. And I'm not going to lie to you, I'm pulling some pretty solid shots in the morning with that setup, okay? I am obsessed with coffee. I got into it a few years ago. I'm an intense person, and I just, like, am so deep into it. I love coffee. And if you love coffee, you may know that we can take that picture down, Britt. Thank you. If you love coffee, you might know that a lot of coffee roasters will actually do something on a bag of coffee on the front, the side, the back, whatever. They'll put something on the bag called tasting notes. And these tasting notes kind of like, they don't help you taste the coffee, but they help you appreciate the richness of the coffee. So if you're not a coffee person, let me give you a few examples. I have a coffee journal here. I hate myself. I really do. But it's helpful for this moment. So this was a coffee from Huckleberry Roasters. It was their Sound and Vision blend. Okay, they wrote this about the coffee. I'm laughing. Dale drinks like a McCafe every day, and he's like, "What are you talking about?" This three-component blend from Brazil, Peru, and Ethiopia is sure to dazzle your senses with comforting notes of chocolatey caramel and a subtle pop of fruit. This is a sensory delight. Put on some David Bowie for a true gift. I love that when they tell you what music to listen to. Put on some David Bowie for a true gift. Tasting notes are caramel, chocolate, and dried cherries. Pretty helpful, right? Okay, I'll give you one more. I didn't really like this coffee, but I'll read the tasting notes for you. Fog Lift Espresso. Okay, they say this. A delightful coffee for a quick weekday morning shot with a rich burgundy-colored crema and syrupy smoothness. The espresso of choice for many local cafes, this dreamy, creamy blend is sure to lift the fog of it off any cloudy Seattle-like day. Notes, tasting notes, buttery caramel, dark chocolate, and toffee. Sounds good, right? Good, because I actually made this espresso for all of you. So, team, will you guys bring this out for the... I'm just kidding. I did not do that. You guys knew it. Those tasting notes, listen, they don't help you taste the coffee, but trust me, they help you appreciate the richness of it. I'm serious, okay? Now, here's why I say this. The vows that we're about to read from Genesis 28, vows that Jacob made at the very beginning of his adult life when he was leaving Beersheba, are like the tasting notes of the moment that we're sitting in this morning when God calls Jacob's name twice. They help us appreciate the richness of the moment. They help us appreciate the kind of love and kindness that God is approaching Jacob with. So let's read chapter 28, verses 20 and 22. These are vows Jacob made when God came to him while he was sleeping, gave promises. Jacob responded with some vows here. Starting in verse 20, it says, Jacob made a vow and he said, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. Jacob says, if you will be with me and keep me if you will give me bread and clothing, if you will return me to my father's land in peace, you will be my God. And the promises that God makes to Jacob at the end of his life in this dream when God repeats Jacob's name, they're like a recapitulation of all the things Jacob had vowed. God says to Jacob, I will be with you. I will keep you. You'll have everything you'll need provided because your son Joseph, who you thought was dead, is actually alive and he's like the head of Egypt. I will bring you up out of Egypt. You will return to your father's land, a promise God kept when Jacob died. He was buried in his father's land in peace. And the kindness of even the son you thought was dead, he's actually going to be the one that closes your eyes. God's love and kindness towards Jacob is so rich. I think his vows reveal this. But here's my favorite tasty note of the vows Jacob made in chapter 28. That the last thing Jacob vowed at the beginning of his adult life, leaving Beersheba, it's the first thing Jacob does at the end of his life when he gets back to Beersheba. The last thing Jacob vowed in chapter 28 was, if you do all these things, I will give you a full tenth of everything that I have. And Jacob arrives at Beersheba, and the first thing that he does, it says, is he offers a sacrifice to God. Now some of you are like, well, it doesn't say full tenth. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, it doesn't. But promise me, we have every reason to believe this was a full tenth. Jacob has everything that he has. He's on the way. He's offering a sacrifice. He said he's going to give a full tenth. And he offers this sacrifice. The last thing that he vowed, the first thing that he does in this moment. And notice that he does this before God has said anything. He does this before God has revealed anything. Jacob offers a sacrifice. Listen to what Victor Hamilton, Genesis scholar, he writes this about this moment. He says that this act of worship is cast as a spontaneous expression of gratitude by Jacob rather than a response by Jacob to any promise from God. Jacob arrives at this place, Beersheba. He's at the end of his life. He doesn't know how long he has left to live. He's on his way to Egypt, somewhere uncertain. He's on his way to a land not promised to him. At the end of a 2-year famine, and he gets there, and before God says anything, Jacob offers a sacrifice. Just think about the things Jacob could have said. Jacob could have gotten there and said, this whole offering sacrifice thing, I don't know, God. Like, I don't know how much long I have left to live. He could have said, I don't know about this giving sacrifice thing. I think I'm going to pass on it because, you know, for the last 2 years, all I've seen is my resources dwindling. He could have said, I'm going to pass on this sacrifice thing because I don't know if you heard God, but I'm on my way to Egypt and things feel pretty uncertain right now. But he didn't. On his way to Egypt, at the end of his life, at the end of a 2-year famine that would actually go on for 5 more years, Jacob offered a sacrifice. Jacob offered a sacrifice. I think that this moment is one of many moments in our Bibles that reveals a biblical portrait of giving as a trusting release of our circumstances and not a token response to them. That this moment where Jacob arrives and before God says anything, he offers a sacrifice is one of many moments in our Bibles that reveals the biblical portrait of giving is one of a trusting release of our circumstances and not a token response to them. Like when we continue to give 10% tithe back to God off of a paycheck that we're not sure if it might be our last one for a while. Or like when we offer our time to a friend who's sold their place or gotten out of their apartment and moved to the next place when all we want to do is fill up the moving vans ourselves and get up out of here. Like when we continue to live generous lives with the financial resources God has given us, like we were when things were up and to the right, even when they're down and to the left. Or like when we sacrifice our energy for a friend or a neighbor in need, when we're not sure if we're going to have the same level of energy that very next day. And we give, we offer, we sacrifice our time, our money, our energy. We do these as a trusting release of our circumstances, not because it's the cool thing to do, not because it's, in our culture standards, the right thing to do or the smart thing to do or the easy thing to do. We do it because we believe and we know that in the midst of uncertainty, He is certain. Listen, if you came to church this morning to hear that you are not going to lose your job and that you are going to sell your house, you came to the wrong church this morning. Because I'm just going to be honest with you. The truth is, like, you may lose your job. You may not sell your house for another year. You may have to dip into those savings again. You may continue to battle this mental health struggle that you've been battling for entirely longer than you ever wished you would have to. But I hope, I pray, I believe that you came to a church this morning that through God's living and active word, God wants to meet with you and speak to you, love and comfort and remind you or tell you in the midst of uncertainty, I am certain. And so we're going to sing a song this morning that it's actually the first song that we ever got to sing together as a church on the Sunday that we launched a few weeks ago. And we're going to sing it this morning in response to God's word for a lot of the same reasons that we did a few weeks ago. Because the truth is, as a church even, like, our future is uncertain, our present is uncertain. I don't mean that in like a doomy, gloomy way. I just mean like we're so new. We're 5 weeks in. We've got so many new faces. We're getting to know each other. We have two pretty full services already, especially the 9 a.m. It's pretty full. We got a building, an old building that we have to take care of, and a ton of land that we got to take care of. We don't know how we're going to clean it. We don't know how we're going to mow it. We don't know how all these things are going to go, right? So much feels uncertain. But we're going to sing a song in response to this reality in our life together as a church and in our own individual lives, because I believe this, that more than we need like fun hangout times like supper to get to know each other, more than we need a parking lot with actual parking spaces in it, more than we need a zero-turn mower or a clean team or a 5-year plan for where we're going to be in 5 years, what we need most is the presence of God to remind us, in the midst of uncertainty, I am certain. That what we need most is the power and the presence of God to fall afresh on this people in this place. Amen? And so we're going to sing that out in response together this morning. Let's sing.